Welcome to Local Talk, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Local Talk is also an audio space for learning radio. We like to think that it's a safe space where we learn from each other here at KHOI. And here we are again, your hosts and lifelong learners, Kay Patak and Ursula Rudenberg. And thank you for listening.
Hello.
I just want to check in right off the bat about the weather. Relatively warm weather will continue this week. That's what's predicted, with days in the 60s and nights in the 40s. And, of course, the big question is when will it freeze? But so far, no frost predicted.
That's good. We had a film screening last Friday. We showed Shadows of Liberty, an investigation of how corporate media consolidation is playing out, especially in how we hear the news. It's about corporate control and so on, censorship of media. It was a good event. We had a completely full house.
Yes, we want to thank you, those of you who came. It was really great having you here. Loved the discussion afterwards, and I learned some things, not only about the national and international scene, but about how things play out here in Central Iowa. And we raised $130 for KHOI.
Oh, so it was a bonus. Cynthia McClure brought refreshments. She's our chef, I guess. Thank you, Cynthia. And there was general agreement that movie nights at KHOI are a good thing. We're going to do more of them at KHOI.
Yeah. The weekend before last, I camped out at the White Rock Conservancy. You may be familiar with the White Rock Conservancy, an Iowa nonprofit land trust of about 5,000 acres of absolutely gorgeous acres of land near Coon Rapids, a little more than an hour's drive west of here. I went for a long walk in the morning along the Raccoon River through fields and forest and with huge old trees and restored wetlands, pastured, and it was really enchanting. Iowa is really, really beautiful in its natural state. And at one point, I followed a path because I was curious to see where it would go, and it ended up on the top of a hill with a ruin of a historic log cabin off by itself under the oak trees. And a sign explained that this was a home that somebody was living in during the days when there were mines in the area. They had a lot of small private mines. And I even went swimming in the Raccoon River before I left. So if you don't know the White Rock Conservancy, it's worth getting to know. It's really one of our treasures. And as well as camping areas, there are a variety of lodges where you can stay, and you can sleep in the historic Garst Farmhouse, the home of Roswell and Elizabeth Garst. And the house, some of us remember, as being where Khrushchev went to visit for about a week. I remember Khrushchev. I saw him here at Iowa State. Oh, wow. So if you aren't old enough to remember that, look it up. Give yourself a treat. Look up Khrushchev visiting Iowa. An extraordinarily beautiful house and location. And there are also smaller cottages to rent there at the White Rock Conservancy. And their website is whiterockconservancy.org. So anyway, I had breakfast on the porch of the farmhouse and met up with Lee Searles, who is also having sticky buns on the porch. And this was a really pleasant surprise because Lee is the creator of the phenology calendar that we use on Local Talk to keep track of events in the natural world, like when certain animals are nesting or when certain plants are growing. And Lee and I got to talking, and he told me that while he is doing his job, which is wetlands delineation, he has been making some very interesting discoveries. So Lee is here with us via telephone. Hi, Lee. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning, Ursula. It's a pleasure to be here.
Hi. For starters, what is wetlands delineation?
It's one of several services that I offer through my small business, which is in ecological consulting. Wetlands delineation is required by the Clean Water Act of the United States for developers, departments of transportation, people who are constructing utility lines along easements, and a variety of other disruptions of the landscape. And what it involves is identifying and mapping wetlands and then collecting the data, which consists of three primary areas: plants that belong in wetlands and wet soils, for one, and for the second part, that would be observations of the movement of water across that area, the hydrology. And the third component of it is soils information. Hmm. There are features of soils that tell you whether or not a wetland is present.
Who are you working for specifically right now in what you're doing?
Well, currently I have a job as an employee with both infrastructure and environment out of Johnston, Iowa. And I also do this work as an independent contractor through my business entity.
You've been making some interesting discoveries as you're doing this, as a side result of your work. Can you explain?
Yes. I'm out in some fairly disrupted areas already, roadways and other places that have had a lot of human impact. And the surprise is that even though there is a lot of non-native brome grass and reed canary grass and a lot of disruption of the soils and the water flow, that there are native survivors, and not just common ones like black-eyed Susans and those sorts of things, but some of the less common species, some of those that we tend to overlook because they aren't flashy, but they're very important plants. They would include plants that are, say, sedges and bulrushes and spike rush and regular rushes. There are also some flowering plants that are a bit flashier, some asters, for example, here and there. And they can be found in roadside ditches, say, abutting a pasture, where the pasture is relatively undisturbed by plowing and a history of cropping.
What's unusual to you about this is that these are plants that were commonly considered extinct, right?
Not necessarily extinct, but perhaps not growing in these tiny patches in these particular ecosystems. And to give you one example, we have a couple of species of bulrush, the hard stem and soft stem bulrush. They tend to be quite tall plants, maybe 4 to 6 feet, and they have no leaves, so they produce all of their energy through the stem, which has chlorophyll in it, and then they'll have a spike of seeds at the very top. And they're commonly found in open water, and on the Des Moines Lobe, the most recently glaciated surface in Iowa, one would expect to find hard and soft stem bulrush in, say, a marsh environment where the waters are relatively quiet. But what I'm finding is that the soft stem bulrush is found just south of the Des Moines Lobe in small streams where, say, for example, next to a road bank, there's a little gravel bar, and somehow the seeds get trapped on that gravel bar. It's not right in the current of the stream, and there you have a little patch of soft stem bulrush. And often it will be pushed down by the water flow, so the stems are laying almost flat. But there it is, clinging to life.
Hmm. You mentioned, I think you used the word degraded areas or disturbed areas. Can you describe a little bit more what exactly those conditions are, like what causes those?
Well, for example, I mentioned road banks. Oftentimes, these areas are highly disturbed by road construction activities. And so there's not only the paved surface, but there's also the rest of the road right-of-way, where graders have come in and, say, built up a roadway, so it lies above the potential flood area in a small creek or tributary. And it's right next to those road right-of-ways where I'm discovering some of these survivor plants.
What you're saying is that even where there's a lot of urbanization or a lot of areas where concrete have been brought in or maybe even agriculture, in between that the natural plants are still asserting themselves, much like birds are nesting in the state capitol building or managing to work somehow with human civilization?
Yes, they are adapting. These are not necessarily ideal situations for these plants, but they have enough flexibility that they can cling to life in such situations. And so it's important, I think, for us to be aware of that, and for landowners who take some interest in preserving our natural environment to go out and locate some of these little spots. They might be a few square feet in size or a little larger, and take an interest in collecting and spreading the seed from these so that these plants are in a greater range of locations and have a higher chance of surviving the disruptions that we're creating.
And why should we care about these plants?
Well, of the ones that I've mentioned, say the sedges and the bulrushes, these are true wetland plants. They have the important function of living in open water or on the edge of a marshy or wet area, and their roots help hold soil in place. They're important in the nutrient cycles in those locations, and they help to remove and store things such as the nutrient pollution that we have here in Iowa in our waterways, nitrogen and phosphorus, for example.
So if somebody has a yard and is possibly wants to be sensitive to what you're describing, can you give just a few tips on what to look for?
Yes. One thing is to have a handy field guide that covers the native plants of the Midwest fairly well. The one I use in the field many times is called Newcomb's Wildflower Guide. It is pretty good for the Midwest, not great, but pretty good. It doesn't cover some of these lesser plants, lesser known plants, such as the bulrushes and sedges. And for that, you need other resources as well. And those tend to be more technical. They tend to be botanical keys, which are a bit difficult to use and understand. They can be mastered with some patience. The best thing to do is to locate a botanist somewhere who's willing to come onto a piece of land and point out what is growing there and where it is and how to maintain those. And so for a landowner or for a person who wants these growing in their own ditch, get in touch with a landowner who has these plants and then collect the seed and distribute it on your own property in the appropriate locations.
So you're really describing the resilience of nature, aren't you?
I am. but that resilience does have limits.
Yeah. You know, it's funny when you were describing the way these plants are managing to grow in very unlikely places, like in between roads. It brought to my mind an image that always struck me when I was living in New York City. Sometimes there would be a triangle of grass between different freeways, and people would be having picnics on these little triangles of grass. And you'd be driving down the freeway, and you'd see like a whole family sitting on this little triangle of grass between the roads, having a barbecue and carrying on family life. And
yes,
it always just astounded me, and it kind of reminds me of what you're talking about. It's just, in a way, that was like human nature asserting itself, family life. And in a way, that's kind of what these plants are doing. They're just growing in these little area, you know, opportunistic areas, right?
Having a little plant barbecue after work.
It always amazes me when I see animals adapt and birds building nests in unlikely places and raccoons moving into attics.
I'm continually impressed with the, I don't know what's called exactly, the faith that life has,
the imperative.
The imperative that life has to go on, despite what we do to it. It goes into a larger theme that is a political football in the state, and that is the quality of our waterways and our remnant marsh and pothole lands. These really are vital landscapes for us to preserve for selfish reasons, because they process some of the runoff pollutants that we have and trap them and reuse them. It's important to keep those kinds of landscapes around. Now, the wetlands delineation work, other than being Big Brother looking over your shoulder, I mean, we hear about that all the time, the intent of the Clean Water Act is not only to clean up our waters, but under one section of it, the swamp buster provisions, the idea is to force industry and business, whenever it is building on wetlands, to replace those wetlands with what's called a mitigation area of roughly equivalent size and quality.
What is a mitigation area?
A mitigation area would be located in an area that's not currently a wetland, but has the potential to become one and remain one for the long term. And so the idea is perhaps to do some modification of the land surface itself so it holds more water or has different sorts of ecosystem possibilities in it, and then to plant it with appropriate seeds so that at least some of the more common plant species survive. And then the animals that are typically found in an undisturbed wetland will come in there and use the area to nest, to breed, to seek shelter, to feed, and so on.
Iowa is basically naturally wetlands, right? I've heard it described as a mosaic between wetlands, forest, and prairie.
I think that's the nicest way to look at it, that there was a significant land surface in the state that was a wetland of one sort or another. Along the rivers, on the river terraces that no longer flood, there would have been riparian or riverside wetlands that may or may not have been forested. Up on the uplands, especially in the Wisconsin or just low glacial surface, there would have been prairie potholes, and a few of those still exist or are being restored now. And it's also interesting that private landowners are increasingly taking an interest in preserving what remains on their land, or in some cases restoring what might have been there at one point 150 years ago.
I saw some beautiful wetlands on the White Rock Conservancy when I took a walk.
One of my favorite places, by the way.
Could I interject something here? Sure.
This reminds me, at the Grassroots Radio Conference we had here, the Meskwaki historian, Jonathan Buffalo, said that Iowa used to be, this is the way he put it, used to be basically all swamp, and the foods that his people had got from the swamps, arrowheads and I forget the other things he
mentioned. And he also mentioned that when the land was tiled, that they lost the cattails, what they built their houses with.
Yeah, and lost a lot of the materials they used that grow in the wetlands, and they have to go so far for them now, out of the state.
Well, we tend to look at a very tiny body of water, say a stormwater retention cell that has a few cattails and red-winged blackbirds in it, and think, that's a wetland. But I wouldn't call that a wetland. It simply lacks the diversity of plant and animal life to count as a true wetland. The kinds of things that Mr. Buffalo was talking about were much more extensive. There would have been places like, for example, Hendrickson Marsh and Snake Creek Marsh and White Rock along the river, where there are very extensive areas that have allowed species diversification to exist and sustain themselves over a long period of time. And you'll get bird life, for example, rails, which are very secretive. They're kind of related to the herons. Rails tend to live in the bulrushes and cattails and other wetland plants. And they kind of skulk around looking for insect food there. And they also nest and breed in wetlands. You get a lot of, say, lesser plants or lesser birds like the bitterns, the American bittern, which is an interesting bird. I was awakened one morning in the 1990s in northern Wisconsin, not in Iowa, via the sound of a very large bullfrog that turned out to be an American bittern. And the sound of one of those going off is, it's understated, impressive. There's a reason why they're called stake driver birds in some parts of the country.
Well, speaking of animals, you are the founder of or the creator of the phenology calendar that has had a big impact on local talk. We use it a lot to track events in the natural world, and I have to say we really, really love it. It's really transformed our show, I think, to be able to track the natural world. So could you describe a little bit what the phenology calendar is?
Yeah, but first of all, thank you for using that as an educational resource. That was the whole point of creating the calendar, to create that greater awareness. To put it quickly, phenology is the study of cycles in nature. Those cycles derive ultimately from the sun's energy. More locally here on the planet, they involve things like the water cycle, the cycling of nitrogen, oxygen, and other specific elements and molecules through the natural system. So phenology is the study of the life forms and how they are affected or how they have an effect on the rest of their ecosystems. That involves bird migrations, the migration of some insects. There are a number of migratory butterflies, for example, that that show up here from the south in the spring and summer. And the initial appearances of migratory individuals, and then they'll breed here. And the birth cycles of mammals and other species. You know, what are red foxes doing when? When does their courtship and mating begin? When do they dig nests and things of that sort? And so phenology includes way too much to put on a single calendar.
Yeah.
But the interesting part for me is that as the calendar goes on, it matures, and I have the opportunity as a photographer to take new pictures every year. So that the 2015 calendar, for example, will have all new photography in it. Not all mine, by the way. There are several other people who contribute photos. And there will be changes in information, adjustments to the flowering date of certain plants based on my own observations compared to what's written down in books somewhere.
So it sounds like you're always improving it a little bit, honing it down.
Always working on it, always adding to it.
And if somebody would like to get one of these calendars, how does one get one?
You can send me an email. That's probably the best way so that my phone isn't flooded with calls. My email address is S, as in Sam, E-A-R-L-E-S, as in Sam again, L-R, and the at sign, msn.com.
Say that one more time.
S-E-A-R-L-E-S, excuse me, L-R, at msn.com. So it's Searles, L-R, at msn.com.
Great. And just a reminder to the listener, KHOI now is being archived on our website, which is a wonderful thing because if you hear information on the radio station that you want to be able to track down later on, you don't have to worry about losing it. You can go to khoifm.org and go to the button that says listen to our archives, and you can find this show and listen to it again and get any information that you might not have been able to write down. It's been a real pleasure to have you on the show again, Lee. Thank you so much, and thank you so much for the calendar. And I love the story you told about how nature is continuing to assert itself through the cracks and ultimately knows that it, at the end of the day, it wins. The natural world is the state of the world, and continues to show itself in a way as a gift to us in between the structures we build that may not be so beautiful. They may be utilitarian, but they don't have the meaning and the longevity that these little plants have, right?
Yes, and it certainly could benefit from a little help from its human compatriots on the planet.
Absolutely. Well,
it's been a pleasure, and thank you for the opportunity to be on KHOI.
Thanks, Lee. Come back again soon. Bye-bye.
I will. Thank you. Bye.
You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. And who better to say goodbye to summer than Janis Joplin?
Who died October 4th, 1970, since she died at the age of 27. I actually saw her perform at what was then called Vets Auditorium in Des Moines, I think in 1970, shortly before she died. Kay, you produce the Community Service Appreciation Program for Local Talk, where each month we feature a local service organization. Tell us who you're featuring this month.
Well, my guest here is Mark Schneider, who's the executive director of the Iowa Arboretum.
Who has just been telling us that they have wetlands at the Arboretum. Is that
right? We do. We have two prairie potholes, representational of palustrine wetlands that existed throughout Iowa. It's just a good educational piece and attracts a lot of native wildlife.
So you could relate a lot to what Lee was saying.
Oh, indeed. Very interesting. And also I have a history of wetland restoration when I lived in Virginia. We restored a wetland along a river on a national fish and wildlife grant. And it's really neat when you can put something back into place that once existed.
I went to the event you had at the Arboretum on the weekend, on Saturday. The Arb Bark. I remember the way you advertised that was, what do dogs and trees have in common? Anyway, I took my old Newfoundland there. She's getting a bit old for a Newfie. And she really enjoyed it. She was much more lively than I've seen her for a long time. I didn't even know about that whole area of the woodland walks on the other side, you know, of the road and the park. It just looked like a parking lot to me with some woods behind it. But you've got all sorts of beautiful trails there, and which we walked on. And as you said, the wetlands, which I didn't get a chance to see on Saturday. But okay, and I know you've got a lot of exciting events coming up at the Arboretum this month, which is what we'd like to talk about mostly. But first of all, I'd just like to ask you about the goals and mission of the Arboretum in general.
Well, the Iowa Arboretum has been set up for Iowans. It was established in 1968 as part of the Iowa State Horticultural Society, and their mission was to grow plants, trees and shrubs and different types of perennials, native habitat, which you walked through this past weekend, for all Iowans. And we do share it with others, but it's just a chance to get outside and connect with nature. That's our mission. And our vision ties into providing education and recreational opportunities for all Iowans again. It's a great space. It's an incredible space, as you found out this weekend, when we turned the Arboretum over to the dogs and their people. But we are dog friendly, and we have oak savanna and prairie and prairie potholes, as we talked about earlier. But on the main piece of land, which is approximately 40 acres, we have over 4,000 inventoried plants. We have trees, large established trees that have been there for almost 50 years. So if you were interested in finding out whether a certain type of oak species does well in Iowa or might grow in your backyard, in your garden, you could come out and look and see what we have.
Yes, and that's one of the things you offer is education about what plants will do well in our soils, in our climate, and so on. Not just trees, but perennials and all sorts of things.
We have established gardens. The nice thing about the Arboretum is it isn't, as you said, just trees, but it's a public garden. It has nicely landscaped perennial gardens, an herb garden, shea garden. So there's a variety of...
Butterfly garden, children's garden.
We have a butterfly garden and children's garden. So there are a variety of things of interest to people that are lovers of trees or lovers of perennials.
And there were sort of Japanese touches, I noticed, too. Sort of not exactly a Japanese garden. I didn't see the whole thing. But the sort of Japanese touches in the landscaping, which I'm very fond of, too.
You have
gazebos and pavilions. And there was a wedding going on when we were there. Well, it was just starting as we were leaving, actually.
Well, we have a lot of events and special events or life events that go on at the Arboretum. It's a destination, but it's also a tradition. And people come to the Arboretum to take pictures, to relax, to connect with nature. It's really an ideal space. It's Iowa's jewel. And I'm not sure how many people, know that it exists and where it is.
You have a lot of weddings there?
We do. Between 18 and 20 a year. It's a great place to have an outdoor wedding. It's very picturesque. If I could bottle it, the tranquility is amazing.
Yeah. Yes, it's very lovely. I'm really close to Ryman Gardens, and this in many ways is reminiscent of Ryman Gardens, but it is, as you say, it's got a more rural feeling and it's more tranquil. You always hear can see the traffic at a distance at Ryman Gardens. I mean, they've landscaped it pretty well to keep it up. But it's a really tranquil place.
Well, like I was saying about the White Rock Conservancy, we're so accustomed to seeing the Iowa landscape as being agriculture that when you go into an area like this where there's old trees and all of a sudden you see how very, very beautiful the land is naturally.
And it's a chance to connect with the land. We have 300 acres of woodland area that we manage. 60 of them are trails, and one trail leads down to Richardson Creek. So you're able to see established ecosystems within the Arboretum, which is really nice. We have a restored prairie, which we have trails through that you can walk. So it is a chance to take yourself and remove yourself from more of a suburban, urban area and get outdoors and be able to walk and see a lot of different things, different types of mushrooms and different types of trees in our woodland area, along with, as I said earlier, our 40 acres of established trees and plants.
Right, and you've got a scenic overlook, an overlook trail, too.
We do. It's amazing. Coming from Virginia, I always thought that Iowa was very flat. But there's a lot of relief to the land. And by walking some of these trails, you really can get a feel for the contour and the topography of the land. It's it's pretty neat. It's really a beautiful, beautiful trail system.
And I have to add, the sort of very modest advertising. I went, as I say, to this dog walk, and it wasn't even advertised. We got lunch, too. There was a beautiful soup lunch and crackers and all sorts of things, cookies.
Well, it was it's a great day. We try to put on a variety of special events that bring people to the Arboretum. In June, we have a car show. This October, October.
I really wanted to talk about all the different events you've got coming in October.
October is a very busy month for us. This coming Saturday, October 11th, we have a program on emerald ash borer, which is devastating our green ashes throughout Iowa and throughout the Midwest. And we're going to have three experts, well-known state experts within the state, and they're going to be talking about emerald ash borer today and then what you should do in the future, whether treating trees or what you should use to replace those trees. It's really a great program and very timely considering what's going on with our ash trees.
This is a topic that's very close to my heart because I've got a beautiful, very big ash tree in my front yard. And in fact, I sort of built the whole yard around it because I've got a shade garden in that front yard. And I've got all these understory trees and orchids and things. And if that ash tree has to come down, it's going to be a big problem for me.
My
neighbor has a smaller ash tree, and they have cut down their ash tree. And I just wondered whether I should try to preserve my ash tree, bite the bullet and cut it down, or it's huge and it shades the house and I'm sure reduces my air conditioning bills too.
Well, this class will really help you make those decisions because they're hard decisions. A lot of it depends on the condition of the tree, the form of the tree, where it's located, the value of that tree, and that you have to determine that and whether you want to try to treat it. And what are your long-term goals for that space? But this class will help you make that decision.
Now, we will have this up on our website, but we'll just tell you people once again when this class is. Saturday, October the 11th, from 9 till 11.
That's correct.
And as you say, you have three experts there talking about the emerald ash borer. Now, this is one of your adult education classes, which is one of the things you offer, but you also have family-friendly events, like the one coming up on the 16th, for example.
We do. On the 16th, we have a pumpkin carving event. It's from 5 to 8, and it's really a fun event. We carve pumpkins for display for our big Halloween event, which is on October 18th. We have two events going on, but the pumpkin carving, we serve hot chili and cornbread and dessert, and it's just kind of a fun evening out with the family or individually to carve pumpkins. We carve over 75 pumpkins that evening, and it's a good way to see the Arboretum and also help the Arboretum in their display of different types of pumpkins.
And on the topic of food, again, I'm a vegetarian. And I should mention my husband was very happy with a Saturday lunch because there was meaty, super stewy things, and I had a vegetarian soup. So I was impressed by that, too.
And we always try to have a vegetarian offering because we have a number of people that are vegetarians at the Arboretum.
But the big event coming up is, or two events, are on Halloween.
We do. On October 18th, from 1 to 3, we have Hullabaloo, and it's for children and their families, children ages K through 4. And we have a hay rack ride. We have pumpkin bowling. We have a launch. When you thought you'd have heard it all, we have pumpkin bowling. We have a maze. We have a leaf area that you can climb around in the leaves for young and for old.
I used to love that when I was young.
We have a apparatus that one of my staff members built, which is for launching apples. So it's really a fun day. A lot of games that can be played along with cupcakes and treats and different types of things.
It says wear costumes for this event.
Definitely wear costumes.
So this is an afternoon event from 1 till 3.
Yes.
And this sounds like a completely non-scary event.
It is. It's for younger children, yeah. And it's a fun event. In the evening, we have an event which is called Our Boo Scare, and it's a little bit scarier. We have a walk in the woods, and when it's nighttime and there's very little light and there's a few surprises in the woods, it's just it's kind of a fun.
It says bring a flashlight.
Flashlight is good, yes. So it's a little bit of a scarier event geared mostly towards families, along with an evening hay rack ride, which is a little bit scarier also because there's no light. Crafts and
but there's
treats.
But there's no ghosts jumping out at you or anything.
Well, not that I know of, but I can't guarantee that.
Yeah, I must admit you had scary titles for these. It's the Walk on the No Return Hidden Trail and Hayride to the Valley of Darkness.
Yes.
Sounds
very
a bit
scary.
Sinister. Yeah, well, we've talked a little bit about this, about the age appropriateness of these different events. The Hullabaloo, that's the afternoon event, sounds like really small children would love that. But the other one is maybe for older kids.
It is.
You've got a lot of things coming up in November, but we hope you'll come back later to talk about those.
Terrific. Thank you for inviting me here today.
Well, thank you so much for coming today and telling us about the Iowa Arboretum. And the Iowa Arboretum is our service organization that we're featuring for this month of October. This is Local Talk on KHY Community Radio. My guest has been Mark Schneider, the executive director of the Iowa Arboretum, which is between Boone and Madrid in Boone County. Thank you, Mark, for telling us about all the exciting activities coming up at the Arboretum. And we'll look forward to hearing from you again later this month.
Terrific. Thank you.
She's looking pretty fine to me now. Oh, yeah. Baby, 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 baby. No, don't you cry. Take two. the sky.
This is Local Talk on KHY Community Radio. This month, we're also thinking about the elections that are coming up in November.
Candidates for the position of county attorney faced off at Ames City Hall on Thursday, which was hosted by the League of Women Voters. And there were also two candidates for a less well-known position.
Yes, Democrat Jim Cheek and Republican Stacey Herridge are both seeking the position of county recorder. And to tell us more about what that position is, we've invited outgoing recorder of Story County, Sue Van de Kamp, to the studio to tell us about it.
Yes, what is a county recorder? What does a county recorder do?
Well, good morning, and thank you for inviting me to come and visit with you this morning. Yes, the county recorder's office is probably the lesser known office in the county. The recorder's office was actually created by the first legislature in 1839. And at that time, we were designated to be the official records keeper for the county. And by records, I mean land records, anything that affects title to property. These documents include land patents, which are transfers from the state to the individual. We had a lot of those when the settlers were coming to Iowa. Today, that means more deeds, mortgages, easements, anything that affects your property. And I'm sure back then they did not foresee the huge apartment buildings, the condominiums, the multitude of documents that are filed to protect, you know, not only the property owner but the lender today.
So it started out as a way of keeping track of land ownership?
Yes. And it's still that today.
So that's the main thing. Because when I think of records, I think of births, marriages,
well,
deaths.
We have those, too. Uh-huh. We have those, too.
So you do keep track of births and marriages and...
That's correct.
Any sort of records that the state has to keep about us? Is that correct?
Pretty much. Pretty much. Yes, we have births, deaths, and marriage records. And actually, they were transferred to our office in 1995 from the clerk of court's office. And it took a change in Iowa law to affect that change. But we've had them for almost 20 years.
Yes. What else do you keep track of?
Our office is also responsible for boat, snowmobile, ATV, ORV registrations. And we also process passport applications.
Hmm. And this, the kind of records you keep, the county recorders keep, varies from state to state, doesn't it?
Yes. Mm-hmm. In some states, they're called, I believe it all falls under the clerk of court's office. Some are called register of deeds. In Iowa, it's the county recorder.
Mm-hmm. And are you trained, are recorders trained as lawyers or?
No.
Oh.
No.
Just good at keeping records.
Just good at keeping records, correct. We do have a continuing education program that I think most recorders attend, and we started that about 3 or 4 years ago.
Because, you know, whenever one buys a house or anything, they do a title search.
Exactly.
And it's always, in my case, always turned out all right. But
yes.
Presumably sometimes it doesn't.
Yes.
And that's what I was wondering
about. Well, abstractors are the ones that do the title searches.
Uh-huh.
And we have one abstract company here in Story County. But they search records not only in our office, but in the treasurer's office and in the clerk of court's office. So it's these three offices where filings can affect your title.
Mm-hmm. And do you work in Nevada?
I work in Nevada at the county administration building.
And how long have you been the county attorney?
County recorder.
County recorder.
Sorry. Yeah, don't tell Steve Holmes you said that. this is my 36th year.
Oh, wow. 36 years.
36 years. And I worked in the office a year and a half before I ran for office.
So this is a sea change.
Yes, it is.
Are there any issues at stake in this election of the county recorder?
I don't think so.
Well, there was something I noticed in the Ames Tribune. I noticed that both the Democratic and the Republican candidate for this position say they support legislative changes that would make it easier for people born to single mothers to get birth certificates at the county rather than at the state level. And I wondered if you could tell us about the background to this proposed legislation.
And that took place in 1995, before we got the records. What the law says at this point is a single parent birth, and that's where only the mother is listed on the birth record, is available only at the state level. If it would have come to us at that time, it would have had to have been a sealed record. And fortunately, attitudes have changed over the years, and they are now available. But anything before July 1st of 1995 is not available at the county level.
Hmm.
It's a sealed record, and as are adoptions.
Right. But that you think that's a – I mean, is the likelihood that that
will change? Probably not. The Department of Health is pretty protective of their records.
Oh, I see. So it'll just – I see.
But it would have to be a state law change.
I see. Just because the state wants to hold on to this function. Or actually, talking of registering births,
mm-hmm.
Obviously when I gave birth, it was a very long time ago. But at that time, and it was in Massachusetts, they didn't ask – they asked the father's profession. They didn't ask the mother. It was just, you know, which peeved me, quite honestly.
Yes.
I don't know if it's the same here in this state.
They don't ask professions.
They don't ask
it's not the fathers or the
mothers.
It's not on the birth record.
Okay.
No.
Okay. So, at least that's equal.
Yes. Yeah.
So we're talking with Sue Vandekamp, who is the outgoing recorder mm-hmm. for Story County, and you've been doing it for 35 years?
This is my 36th, yes. At the end of December, I'll have been here 36 years.
So when you leave this office, you're going to take a vacation?
I'm heading to Florida. After last year and the 20 below weather, I decided this would be a good way to start retirement.
Well, thank you for coming in. And you've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. We've been speaking with Sue Vandekamp, who's the outgoing county recorder. And also earlier in the show, we spoke with Lee Searles about the phenology calendar and the discovery of native plants in the cracks between our streets. And as part of our county community service appreciation program, we also spoke with Mark Schneider from the Iowa Arboretum, and we'll be speaking about the Arboretum throughout the month of October as part of our community service appreciation program. And we've I guess we're coming to the end of our show.
Why, the music's there. Our theme music is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley.
We've been your hosts today, Ursula Rudenberg and Kay Patak. And Rick Morrison is our engineer, as he always is on Mondays. And you can find this show and past shows on our website, khoifm.org, with links to relevant information. And remember that khoifm.org is also the location where you can hear our station streamed live on the air and also find archives of past shows. So if there's ever a show you'd like to hear again or information you'd like to hear, go to the link that says listen to our archives and you can listen to the shows again. Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show. And if you would like to join our team, help and cover whatever you think is relevant, call us at 292-2878.
We always welcome more reporters. Make less work for us.
We do. Yeah, it's a learning experience, right? We're all growing together. So thank you for listening today. And as always, your participation as a listener is what makes KHOI and Local Talk possible. So thank you for listening.
And see you again on the radio.